don't worry, I'm not going to give you a long list of sponsorships and things that you need to buy. Instead, I'm just going to explain. What we do is we teach baking as lifestyle medicine. This is an evidence-based approach to baking, eating, and sharing bread that improves the gut microbiome and mental health. So let's just get straight into this podcast.
This evening, I'm really, really delighted to catch up with our in-house GP, Dr. Alexandra Davidson, to use her full title, or the lovely Dr. Alexandra Davidson.
Thank you very much.
And for those of you who don't know Alex and haven't met her before, Alex is not only an NHS doctor, and she works in practice. Sometimes, you know, I'll catch her in surgery between patients. She's also a functional GP. Now, before I go on too much further, Alex, what would you say is the main difference in real terms between an NHS GP and a functional GP, because obviously you're both?
Yeah, so I think most people, well, hopefully everyone on the call knows what has been to see, well, I hope they don't have been to the doctor very much, but can that have an image or an understanding of what an NHS GP does? And we are, you know, a key part of the NHS. We're kind of like, you know, working on the shop floor along with everyone else at the moment. But we are, I guess we're restricted in the NHS by budgets. We're restricted by needing to practice evidence-based medicine, which I think is a good thing. But I think we shouldn't be evidence limited in what we practice. And that's where the functional side of things come in. And I think what we often get trapped in with the NHS medicine is, and some people on the call may be able to relate to this, or someone that they know in their network, they may know of someone with an illness that's been managed this way, is we treat symptoms in the NHS. So if you've got heartburn, and we're going to cover this with one of our questions, if you've got heartburn, we'll give you something for the acid. What functional medicine does is say, well, why have you got the heartburn in the first place? So the NHS manages symptoms for the most part and treats people very much, I think, and this, I'm not being negative, this is just the limits that we have. The NHS is an incredible being, an organism, but we are constrained because we're publicly funded. And what we've split into really is this sort of silo medicine and this very specialist-driven medicine. If you've got a heart problem, you go to a heart doctor. Headache, you go to the neurologist. If you've got a problem with your bladder, you go to the urologist. But actually, what functional medicine says is, well, hang on a minute, your irritable bowel syndrome and your brain fog and your aching joints and your migraines, there are lots of different systems. They're all linked. Probably we've got to go back to the root cause. If we find that root cause, we can address a systems-based problem, not an organ-based problem. So as a functional medicine doctor, what I do in that world is I treat people on a systems base, that we're all linked. And that actually it's not just, we're not just a bunch of cells, but what we're actually doing is we are looking at the mental, emotional and spiritual piece, which is absolutely key to being well or to getting well if you're not well. So it's holistic. It is evidence-based, but it goes back to that thing I said at the beginning, it's not evidence limited. And so there is a real art to that kind of medicine. And I think that's where my great joy is, because that's why I signed up to be a doctor. So it's quite different. But of course, our end goal in both is want to help people get better, essentially.
That's an amazing description, and I think today's webinar is going to be roundabout. We're going to stick to chatting on subject today for about 30 minutes, and then we'll open the floor for questions.
Perfect.
One of the things I would say is we're recording the webinar, so it can be viewed again. So if you have to leave halfway through, you can come back and we will put this one on for club members. And this will be a club members and diploma video for people who are members only. The guests are muted during the recordings, but when we're asking questions, they can talk to you directly. Feel free if you need to leave the end of the webinar, anyone. We don't watch who's staying and who's going. We know that real life sometimes takes over. And it normally takes us, and bearing in mind it's over Easter, it could take about a week for us to get this video back live on the In Conversation. So I really want to focus on something today, as I'm kind of going to be doing a little bit of baking. I've got a few questions, Alex. The first, and I'll go through a few of them, and perhaps you can sort of begin to answer some of them in a minute. I would like to know what IBS is, because it's so broad. And I would like to know the triggers for IBS, and then we'll come back to looking at bread and sourdough and how that might help. I'd love to know if there is a relationship between IBS and mental health. I know I read a very interesting study recently talking about the relationship, and the number of people who have depression was significant. It was an Australian study. It's on our database, but it was a report looking into the way that IBS affected people's feeling their mental health and what the association is. And then perhaps we could maybe talk about some of the approaches using bread making that people can actually actively step up to help people with IBS and make sure that it is IBS. There are others that are very, very similar that I will talk to you as we go on. So going back to what is IBS, can you give me a definition of what it is?
The simplest definition, Vanessa, is we have no idea. And that's the problem. So IBS is strung under an umbrella term of functional gut disorder. What that means is that if we biopsied, if we opened up people with IBS, and I'm one of those patients, if we opened up IBS patients, people who complain of irritable bowel syndrome, they would look totally normal. And that therein lies the problem. So it's a functional problem. We can't biopsy you and go, oh, look, you know, like with celiac disease, you know, there's a complete anatomical abnormality here, or there's inflammation there. Everything looks normal, but clearly, because of people's symptoms, it's not normal. So it's a functional gut disorder. And it's characterized, the main symptoms that people report are bloating, are abdominal pain, and then people often are either bunged up, they're either constipated, or they're rushing to the loo and they're diarrhea. But for the very unfortunate people, they can be bunged up or they're rushing to the loo. And symptoms are often better when people have gone to the loo. Some people find identifiable triggers, but really it's very difficult to manage in the NHS. It's very difficult to manage full stop, really, because we don't really know the underlying mechanisms. It's felt that probably key players in irritable bowel syndrome are problems with motility. So what I mean by that is the gut is a huge muscular organ. And if that doesn't contract properly, then you can imagine that digestion doesn't work very well. Things either get, if it's too slow, you're bunged up and things ferment. And I know, Vanessa, we're going to talk about fermentation and things with the sourdough regarding that. If it's too quick, then things are rushing through, they're not being absorbed well, and they're ending up in the large bowel, undigested, unaltered, and there's problems there. So it's a tricky one. But, and I think the key thing that we want our audience to know is it's very underdiagnosed. So we think roughly, and Vanessa, you talk about this in your sourdough book, that about up to 20% of a population has got irritable bowel. I suspect it's much more than that. And the reason I think particularly in the UK it's much more is the UK does not like to talk about bowels. Women are much more likely to go to the doctor. Women don't like bloating because, we wear, tighter fitting clothes, and I think bloating is something that females tend to know because of the time of the month. We can see our bellies up and down. And it's not a nice feeling. And I think women are more likely to present to the doctor. They're more likely to have irritable bowel syndrome. But I think a lot of it's underdiagnosed because no one wants to go to the GP and say, I'm really farty, I'm really bloaty, and I'm running to the loo all the time. I think a lot of people just put up with it. They say, well, that's always been me. I've always had bad guts. And I think that's why we've got a tip of an iceberg with irritable bowel, actually.
So, Alex, I'm going to ask you a question that actually has been asked of me recently by one of my students. Around about the time that she has her period, her proestrogen, I think, drops. And then she gets constipation. And is that a very common thing to happen during a woman's cycle? So are there times of the month when it's not IBS, it's actually hormones dropping?
Well, I think the key thing with someone actually asked a question, we can cover it later, we can cover it now, about sex and IBS, which I thought was a great one. I've never been asked about sex and IBS, but actually IBS is very hormonally sensitive. So I think the reason it's more common in women is it's linked to estrogen and progesterone. Those are the female hormones. Testosterone, which is a male hormone, very dominant male hormone, women do have testosterone. Testosterone seems to be a bit more protective, which is why I think we see a lot more IBS in women. But definitely what you find with women who've got irritable bowel syndrome is they see their symptoms cyclically along with their period. They can map their irritable bowel. And the question about sex was, does sex make irritable bowel syndrome worse? And I'll cover it now because we're talking hormones, and I think it's a good question. It definitely does. because when you're having sex, actually sex hormones increase inflammation, which I didn't know. I had to go and do a bit of research on this. That was really interesting. So you've got, if you're more inflamed because of sex and your sex hormones, then you're more likely to have bad irritable bowel.
Is that estrogen coming up, or is there any?
Yeah, so it's estrogen and progesterone. And the other thing is that because when, you know, there's a particular hormone with the pleasure side of sex called oxytocin. Now, what that does is drives all the good stuff. But because it's very excitatory, which is, of course, what everyone loves, it also makes your other organs very sensitive. So if you're somebody who's got a sensitive gut, the irritable bowel syndrome people, if they're having sex, that big rush of good hormone, the pleasure hormones, actually makes their gut much more sensitive. So they tend to actually find their irritable bowels worse with sex. So it's very hormonal driven. So your student definitely is, it could be irritable bowel, or it could just be the female gut being more sensitive to hormone.
So we know that we've got, you know, I mean, I've read lots of studies this week because April is, I think it's World, or it could be National IBS Month or World IBS Month. I can't remember, but I know that this is the month that kind of all the charities kind of really get on board with it. So when you've got IBS, I've had a few scary moments, Alex. So one of the problems I've had over the last 10 years is I've had 6 people who've been very specific about their bowel issues, somehow willing to talk to me, a baker, about them, but too embarrassed to talk about it with a doctor, which is it's very interesting.
With terrifying people.
Yes, absolutely. But one of the difficulties is, and one of the things that really frightened me half to death was in the very early days, and it's happened, I mean, you have to imagine, I speak to hundreds and hundreds of people, but over the past decade, I would say I've caught 5 absolutely definite people who've got bowel cancer.
Yeah.
Very common. I was horrified to discover that I think at the moment it's the number 4 cancer in the UK. We are told that it is a preventable cancer in many instances, not all, but in many, because its lack of fibre is one of the drivers towards
it. Yes.
And one of the reasons that we're so driven by increasing fibre. There are some very similar, and what we see is it's a very similar problems that look like IBS, and people self-diagnose, I've got gluten intolerance, hence they come to me because they think sourdough must be the answer. And when I listen to what they've told me, my alarm bells have gone off, and I thought to myself, every time anyone speaks to me about themselves personally, I'm literally have to say, go straight to your GP.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm not, but I'm not a GP, you are. So what are the alarm bells as a GP that you are like, do you know what? You really have to get your actual backside.
I think it's a really important point. I think there are what we call the red flags, where, like you said, the alarm bells, and these are things which can be age-related. So anyone over 60 that has things like change in bowel habits. So someone always says, like, I'm regular as clockwork after my morning coffee, and actually I'm finding I'm going 2 or 3 times a day. So loose, going to a more loose pattern, that can be an alarm bell, depending on the age. Unexplained bleeding from the back passage, which not piles. So it's not an obvious thing. Again, it depends on your age. But again, if you're worried, speak to your GP, particularly if you've got bleeding that you're not sure where it's coming from. Any weight loss, which is unintentional. I think most people have gone the other way with a lockdown. But, you know, if you suddenly think, hang on, my belt notch is doing it up, that, and you haven't been actually actively doing anything, you're more tired. They're very vague symptoms, people, but they can be very real in terms of diagnosis. So changes in bowel habit, particularly towards more loose, and bleeding, I think, are key. And if you're young, if you're 40s or 50s, then it's a few other things like the unintentional weight loss.
So I'm going to talk about triggers here for IBS. And I'm also, as is probably some people struggle with slightly, we're talking about poo, whilst I'm going to be talking about cherries and star anise. But we're going to talk about sourdough and triggers. So for this recipe, what I've done here, Alex, is I've actually mixed with Ethan earlier on today, at my new apprentice, a dough.
And it's right.
It's about 75% hydration at the moment. Yep. It's been sitting here. We mixed about 5 o'clock, so it's about 3 hours old. We're going to ferment this one ambiently. Now, interestingly, for anyone who's got IBS, I do not recommend that they ferment ambiently. I like anyone with IBS to ferment on a retarded loaf, because you get a higher level of acid, and that breaks down something called FODMAPs a little bit more, which I'm going to ask a little bit more about FODMAPs from you as I'm doing this. What I want to show you, in fact, I'm going to walk over and just show you. This dough is nice and shiny. I may actually turn it into a ball. I'm just going to see how it's behaving.
Right.
Beautiful and shiny.
Yeah.
Now, if you've got IBS, you can't use this. And these are the cherries and the sultanas, because the sugars in here would actually drive people doolally.
Blow you up.
Yeah, absolutely. I know that there are times that I haven't been able to eat these things and I do look like I'm 6 months pregnant the next day and I clear the room. So
I know it well.
So it's one of those things that if people have got IBS, those kind of fruits can drive them mad. Interestingly, this has got aniseed in, and I don't know if you remember the other one we were chatting. So this is butter, a little bit of
yes, that's butter, right.
And aniseed. Now, interestingly, and this is that link I was talking to you about earlier, is I'm just going to tumble these in. Interestingly, aniseed, in one of the studies that I'm going to be sharing with a couple of my recipes, has been shown not only to alleviate gas and flatulence and IBS, it also alleviates depression, which is amazing.
That's right.
You see both symptoms, you know, alleviated, is actually rather beautiful. It's a gorgeous flavour. I really would say that adding some anise to your bread or to your bakes is, it's delicious and it's easy. And if it lifts your mood as well, even better.
Yeah.
So I'm just putting these into the dough. There's quite a few. I'm just going to dimple those. And while I'm doing that, I'm just doing it with wet hands, just to get them in a little. There we go. Alex, what FODMAPs? Can you just...
Yes.
Because I talked to a lady this evening who told me she'd been on a... This afternoon, who told me she'd been on a FODMAP-free diet for a year. Which
That's a disaster. So FODMAPs are fermentable carbs. So that there are five different groups of carbohydrates that none of us, even those who don't have irritable bowel, can digest well. So they're always going to be fairly undigested when they hit our large bowel. But for those of us who've got irritable bowel syndrome, we are really bad at digesting these. There are lots of different foods which are FODMAP. Now, the issue we've got is that FODMAPs are incredibly good for our gut if we're not in irritable bowel that reacts to them. Because FODMAPs are prebiotic. What that means is they are a food for our microbiome. So they're a food for our gut bugs, which means that they help our gut bugs to flourish, which keeps us healthy. But if you're an irritable bowel syndrome person and you're sensitive to FODMAPs, then these will blow you up. And they're really good stuff, which is in everything like garlic and onion, particularly. It's tough to do. Inulin's one of them, exactly. So it's in chicory, leeks, all that kind of stuff. Now, they are great if you can tolerate it. But what happens is if you've got irritable bowel syndrome, you have lots of FODMAPs in your diet, is that those carbs will go straight through to the colon undigested, where the bugs in the colon will literally go like a Christmas buffet and go berserk. And what happens is you get lots and lots and lots of gas when you ferment. So this will make people really bloated, lots of pain. So often you'll find people who have a very garlicky meal, or they have something, a lot of onion or leeks, they'll blow up like a balloon, or, you know, all things that are like dried fruit, like Vanessa, you were mentioning earlier. And so what you can recommend to people with irritable bowel syndrome is, and I would recommend as a GP, is look, go on a low FODMAP diet. What that means is that you identify the FODMAPs, and there's loads of apps and books that you can use, and you really reduce them down in the diet. Now, I started this by saying that FODMAPs are incredibly good for us, and we want to have as many FODMAPs in our diet as possible because of the effect they have on the gut. So this is a medical intervention. You would go on a low FODMAP diet for about 6 weeks. What that does is it calms everything down. You then reintroduce, there are five groups of FODMAPs, and you do a very strict reintroduction, which follows a very strict plan. You introduce one of a group, see how you react, and then go on from there. And what you're hoping to identify is lots of foods that you can now tolerate. The problem is that people who've got irritable bowel syndrome, of which I am one, and I did this because I wasn't well versed, is I did the low FODMAP plan, felt great, and 75% of us will feel good, very good on a low FODMAP. I mean, it changes your life if you've got a bad irritable bowel. You never introduce FODMAP again. So you stick on a very restrictive diet. Now, because you restrict so many FODMAPs, your microbiome becomes less diverse. And if you've got Vanessa's book, you'll know how important it is to have a very diverse microbiome. And sourdough and all her botanical blends are all about diversity. If you cut that diversity out, your microbiome dies off, you have very little diversity, and that massively impacts your health. So your woman, Vanessa, that's now been on the low FODMAP diet for a year, is actually going to be impacting now much more negatively on her health because she's so restricted.
There was a study, and so one of the problems we have with wheat is, of course, is that whole grain is full of these sugars. And in particular, so they're called fermented oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols, which took me a while to learn to say that. But the sugar in wheat, undigested wheat, so bread, whole grain bread especially, can be a big trigger. So one of the things that people find is that if they have IBS, that they can tolerate sourdough. And that is because correctly made sourdough, and I really do really emphasize that,
yeah,
has got has had the wild yeast and the lactic acid bacteria. I don't know if you can see on the pot on the left, they're actually escaping right now.
I know, I was seeing that.
They're on the run.
That's a good start. Look at that. That's what you'll dream of, a starter like that.
It's climbing out the pot, Alex.
Right. I can smell it from here.
So, yeah, I'm just laughing. It really has just gone absolutely crackers. So that is going to be munching through, breaking down, and then kind of easiest thing to think of is it's almost kind of reforming the sugars, but in a different kind of...
They're transformed, aren't they?
Yeah, and the microbes actually use many of the sugars that the microbes in our gut would normally use. So the microbes in our gut can't use some of those sugars, so therefore many sourdoughs are considered to be low FODMAP. So something to bear in mind, though, I very strongly suggest to anyone who doesn't eat bread because they've got IBS to very, very, very slowly reintroduce whole grain, so 10% at a time. So the program that we have for people who have got IBS, and I often guide people on a program, it takes about between 3 and 4 months to slowly reintroduce fiber into the diet. So even if you think, yay, sourdough, not all sourdoughs are the same. Okay, sourdough isn't just sourdough. So shop-bought sourdough can be fake sourdough. You can have short fermented sourdough. You can have warm fermented sourdough that hasn't broken things down enough. Like, for example, some ambient bakes might not. I'm going to walk around here and just show this to you, Alex. So it's very much a question of very long, slow fermented. I would say at the least 36-hour long, slow fermented, and increasing the percentage of the fiber a little bit at a time. So look, can you see?
Yeah, fantastic.
So I'm going to turn this into, I'm going to see if it works into a ball. If it doesn't, I'm going to put it in a tin. So either which way, I'm going to see if the gluten's still strong enough. A tin will hold it up if it isn't. And I've got my trusted assistant on my over here, who's going to be doing the next loaf in a second. So I'm just stretching. Can you see I'm just stretching that ball, lifting it.
This is good for me to see, actually, because when I do my inclusions, I think I'm kind of winging it a bit, so I'm getting a lesson here.
This sounds really strange, Alex, but the less you handle it, the better. People overhandle it, especially if they're new.
And okay.
I've got to do this. So I'm literally lift and flap over, lift and flap. And you can see this is one of the shortcuts from the 10-minute loaf.
Yeah.
So this. That's it.
Great.
So I'm going to pick that up in a second. And people really do mess the dough around. So I virtually haven't touched it.
Yeah.
It's really, really. So I'm also belt and braces on this one. It's going to be quite sticky. So I'm going to dust the bannet on. So a little bit, if you've got a problem with gluten, obviously you can use potato flour or rice flour. You don't have to use, like I am here, a roller milled white. But I really, really want to put Belter Race on this. Now, I think personally, and Ethan, who, Ethan and I made an executive decision this afternoon. Let me introduce you to my apprentice.
Hello. Excellent, Ethan. I've seen you on Instagram. Great to meet you, sir.
Nice to meet you.
So Ethan and I made an executive decision that we thought the star anise butter and cherries would go well with sesame seed.
Oh.
Okay, so we're going to spray this on two ways. So Ethan, have a really good generous sprinkle on there. Like really generous.
Really generous.
Yeah, yeah. So these sesame seeds, Vanessa.
Yeah, sesame seeds. And we're going to cover it in sesame seeds. We can do more.
More.
Yeah, yeah.
Really generous.
Yeah, yeah, be generous. That's it. Now the sesame seeds are going to provide a barrier. Okay. Again, if people have IBS, sesame seeds are not always the best things. Any seed that can get caught in the bowel is actually can be quite annoying. So, and actually, again, like with other things that are, you know, yeah. They can actually cause a lot of problems if you have IBS seeds. So sometimes if you pre-soak them, it activates them and they don't cause so many problems.
Yep.
Sometimes, and we do the same with this, as far as I'm concerned, you can't have too many sesame seeds.
Quite right.
Okay. And so sometimes it's not, it depending on who you are, you don't always want to be including sesame seeds in something like this. So I've used about, I would say, 6 heaped tablespoons. I'm just literally going to pick this up. I'm going to drop it in here. So my last pickup, Alex, you can see.
Yeah.
We call this, I'm going to make you laugh, okay? I'm going to put down a second. When we pick it up, we call it dead cat.
Yeah, yeah. Listen, I've got one.
Sorry.
It's like an absolute dead cat lump.
It's going to be incredibly offended at this. So we're picking it up. It's a little bit like a dead cat. And as I put it in, I'm kind of folding it over on itself.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to put a few more sesame seeds on there. Ethan, do you want to take that round and just show that to Alex so she can see it in there? Excellent. Right, while Ethan just shows that to you and just talks you through it a little bit, I'm going to just wash my hands a little bit.
Yeah, that looks absolutely cracking. Brilliant.
It's nice.
Yeah, fantastic.
That's quite a nice little, you know, little nifty trick. Very easy. So that's really one of the kind of examples out of my new book, which is just called 10 Minute Sourdough.
I'm on 10 hooks for that book, literally, because I spent about 5 hours making my loaves the other day.
So we're just going to pop that for, it's got a little bit cold sitting here on the deck. So we're just going to pop that in the prover for about 10 or 20 minutes. No, it'll be fine for now because it's got the seeds on, but you catch you guys normally what I would do, you know. See, I've got him ever so well trained already. Waxed off, right.
We all need an Ethan.
Yeah, we do. He's mine. And in a minute, he's going to do another recipe for us. I'll just clear the deck over here. So, Ethan, do you want to grab hold of the naan bread? Okay. So, Alex, with IBS, what would you say? Bread making has many opportunities, doesn't it, to kind of relieve stress, to kind of break down and long slow ferment the ingredients that are a problem. What would you say are the key features as a GP that you say about sourdough that is different from normal yeasted bread?
Normal yeasted bread should be banned, as far as I'm concerned. So I think that is basically the root cause of a lot of health. I mean, we know we are drowning in preventable lifestyle related illness, most of which is obesity and or diabetes. And I think what I find very interesting as a GP is when I speak to patients and I say, look, you know, your blood results are back, or you've got your knee pain, or, you know, whatever, heartburn's a big one. And they say, oh, but doctor, I eat a really good diet. Usually because they're listening, and I'm not knocking people who grow their own veg, but often what they'll say to me is, well, I have cereal and toast in the morning, or they have a big bowl of, you know, cereal with a lot of fruit. Then they have a sandwich at lunch and, you know, some sort of pastry type, you know, pie or something in the evening. And because they're not eating junk, they think it's really a healthy diet. But what you hear is white beige, and lots of processed bread. And actually, processed bread is incredibly high in salt. It's incredibly high in sugar. And what it does when it hits the body is it sends your own blood sugar rocketing. Your insulin tries to catch up and you're on this roller coaster. So what I say to patients is carbs fuel carbs unless they're the right ones. So normal bread should be banned because I don't think it confers any health benefits. And I think it's at the root cause of a lot of health problems, along with lots of other things. Whereas sourdough is a gift of health in a holistic way. We started talking about holism. I think we've got Sapna Shah as one of our participants, and they were saying about, you know, how that, you know, they wish that actually health is approached in a much more holistic way. Sourdough offers that because you've got the making of the bread. For those of us who are sourdough bakers, it's mindful. And what I love about you, Vanessa, when I watch your Instagram lives, and we spoke about this, you know, is how much you talk about the flow and the connecting emotionally and spiritually with the bread. So you'll film yourself, you know, some of your videos in the club where you'll just say, now I'm connecting the bread, I'm holding the dough. And I think that mindfulness starts the process. One of the triggers of irritable bowel syndrome is stress. What is causing a lot of irritable bowel syndrome? A COVID pandemic. So if you're making bread, you've got stress relief. You've got mindfulness. You've got calming relaxation. You've got process. And I think it allows you to pause, and you've got creation within that. And you've got the ability to gift and share with others. And I think with sourdough, you've got a long ferment. You push that ferment as hard as you can. You make the bread much more digestible, much less fermentable in the gut by being fermented. Higher fiber, which helps our gut much more than the white plastic Pullman loaves. And suddenly you've got in a sourdough a complete gift of health, a mental, emotional, spiritual, which is the core, is what we need.
So mental health is part of this kind of thing with IBS. So I'm going to ask Ethan to mix up a dough now. And what I'm going to ask him to do is something slightly strange. I'm going to ask him to kind of like almost kind of close his eyes so he connects with the process. Yeah. And it sounds like a really stupid thing to do, but sometimes you can kind of really kind of connect to the dough itself as you're making it. So in the first instance, I use a wooden spoon. It's just what I do. It's actually one that was made for me by a friend of mine. Made to fit my arm, as you can see. You don't have to. If you want to, you can get your hands straight in, but it can get incredibly sticky. And what Ethan's actually measured out in this bowl is 250 grams of a white roller mill flour, that's 13.5%, and 250 grams of a whole grain flour. It's not my diversity flour this time. Sometimes I get a new flour and I will try it out. When we do it next week, we'll use a diversity blend. So we often, when we're testing and developing recipes, we'll test two or three different types of flour just to make sure that the recipe is sitting well. So when we do the vegan version, which we will be doing with a vegan yogurt, we'll be trying it with a diversity.
Right.
So Ethan, if you want to, so 500 grams of flour, 250 grams of each. 10
grams of salt.
Yeah, 10 grams of salt.
Oh, is the salt already in there?
Yeah,
everything together.
Yeah.
What kind of salt is it?
Sea salt, only sea salt.
Lovely.
Only other sea salt.
Cool. So what we're going to do as well is we're going to put some of that mental sourdough starter in. What did you do to it?
I
think that was me. I think Ethan just looked at it sideways and it just went absolutely crackers. So we want around about 100-150 grams of sourdough starter in there. So I would say, if you put the water in there, so we've got 220 grams of water, 100 grams of yogurt in there. And what I'm going to do is I'm just going to measure this. It's like a back measurement. So I'm going to put 150 grams of this in. Okay. There we go. That's about 100 grams.
Is this a white starter, Vanessa, this one?
Here's a white starter, this one. Yep. And I put 122 grams in. 137. So that's 150 grams of starter. Ethan's going to put the yogurt and the water in there, and then he's going to mix it together while I wash my hands. So, Ethan, just talk through what you're doing.
Well, I put the water in.
What yogurt are you using, Ethan?
We're using Greek style coconut organic yogurt.
The only one we had in the house.
Fair enough. I agree wholeheartedly.
Can you see?
Yeah. Cut his head off.
Oh, sorry. We can't have his head cut
off. Let's get the star of the show back. He's a tall lad, though, so you...
How tall are you, Ethan?
6'4" or 5".
Wow. What's the weather like up there?
That's it. In you go.
Right.
Mix. So the nice thing is, this is, we're making naan bread, and this is a genuine Indian, it's a keema naan, sorry. But this one is a basic naan bread recipe, and this is a genuine bowl from India.
Yeah, wow, fantastic.
So it's a really nice bowl, and what's kind of lovely is, as Ethan's using that, he's got... a spoon that was carved for me by one of my best friends, and he's using a hand carved bowl from India. And it sounds really silly, but you were talking about IBS and that moment where you have to de-stress. Why is stress triggering IBS? The hormones obviously are part of it. And how on earth do we de-stress? Well, doing something like this where you're connecting, you've got a stoneware bowl and a wooden spoon, it's part of the joy.
It makes life simple again. I think we're in a society where we've overcomplicated life, we've got lots of plates spinning, we're easily distractible with our alerts on our phones. And I think what I like about making bread is it stops time. I think it allows you to pause and reflect and create. And I think we've lost that. And I think, you know, stress causes leaky gut. It really flares up your irritable bowel. It makes you inflamed. And I think the process of bread making is something really very extraordinary.
So I think it's very much, what I'm going to ask Ethan to do now is probably everybody's favorite bit. So Ethan, if you just scrape that down with your hand, pop your spoon down, and then before you put your hand in the water, put your hand into the jug and make your hand wet, and then start working the dough.
Okay.
Yeah. And then this bit is probably my favourite bit, and it's cold water now. It was warm earlier. But this bit where you actually get your hands in the dough, and you kind of start working it in. So really work it in. You can't go wrong at this point, Ethan. So really work it in. We decided that we need to fix the bench because it creaks. It's my bench. It was a dressmaker's bench from Leicester, so it's had a bit of a life, to say the least. So this is really interesting, and I just want to give a quick tip here, Alex. When you're mixing new flours up, this particular flour is not what I was expecting it to be. And as Ethan was looking at the protein content after I'd edited it, go on, say how much.
15.8 grams.
What, really?
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's not the one I was thinking of then.
No, we tried this out. It's a Wessex Mill wholemeal flour blend. Now, Wessex Mill in Oxfordshire, there's absolutely no way that this grain is British English grain at 15.
How interesting, yeah.
So one would assume, which I did, that it would be a low protein flour. I was thinking 12 and a half when I said, but it's not, it's 15.8. Now, what will happen is Ethan follows the exact recipe, which I've given to him, this dough is gonna be really tight.
Right.
Now, also with it being tight, Alex, it's not gonna have quite enough fermentation going on because the water triggers the enzyme. So if you're going to break down, you know, your bread, more water triggers more enzymic activity, triggers more breakdown. So often the higher hydrated breads are actually easier to digest because the enzymes have got busier.
Yeah.
So with this particular flour, here's tomorrow, the naan breads will be tight. They may be slightly under fermented. And so one of the things I'm going to ask Ethan to do is a tiny adjustment. Now, with 1 or 2% difference of protein in the flour to what I was expecting. For every 1.5 grams of difference, I had made an adjustment by about 10 grams of water. If you just show Alex the, just show, can you see?
So how's that? So how's that handling? Is it sticky or is it fairly manageable?
Very sticky.
Yeah, yeah.
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to add about 20 grams more water. There we go. And trust me, I'll have measuring hands. Have a thermometer in there.
Just like your magic hands that never stick to the dough like me, which stick like flipping glue.
I have magic hands. So really kind of push that in with your heel, remember?
Oh,
yeah. Keep going. Yeah? All yours. So, Alex, while Ethan is working that dough, he's got about 2 or 3 minutes to work it.
Yeah.
Ethan, one of the things that is really interesting about working the dough is actually feeling it, and you're sensing the dough coming together, you're sensing the temperature, how sticky it is. So actually, when you're making sourdough, it's not simply a matter of mixing it and not thinking about it. You all day I've been asking Ethan to smell things, taste things. So it really is important that you connect to your dough. And that's what makes you a really good baker.
This is the pause.
Blowing it down. Absolutely. So while Ethan's doing that, can we open the floor for any questions?
Yeah. I was going to say that'd be great, actually. And one thing I just wanted before we do questions is, going back to Satna again, I think this is a really, I want to honour this comment. Satna said, I did not realise how much my IBS has affected me until this talk, as feels very emotional. It can be so debilitating, and I battled one way or another all my life. Thank you. And I want you just to, I want to say thank you for sharing, because I equally have suffered with irritable bowel for a very long time. And it wasn't until I really found bread making that I actually realised I could enjoy things again and stop being so obsessed and restrictive about food, which is something which makes me hugely happy. And I think you're right, Satna, that actually it's extremely emotional, not only because of the symptoms, which can be difficult, but actually, you know, Vanessa touched on it, but the whole mental health and gut health link and the gut-brain connection, that actually our happy hormones, the serotonin, which we want to harness and have lots of, 80% is made in the gut. So if your gut's not happy, you ain't going to be happy. That's it. Because there's much more traffic going from the gut. There's 2/3 traffic going up to the brain from the gut and 1/3 going down. So we know about people that say, oh, gosh, I'm nervous, I've got a jippy tummy. We can hear, we can understand that traffic, but the traffic from the gut is more, and it's more important. So I think you're right that actually when your gut's not happy, you're not happy. And the more that we can help harness gut health, prioritise gut health alongside the mental, emotional, and spiritual, the happier they're going to be. So I think you're right. And I think the more that, you know, Vanessa's doing such a great job in educating about this and about, you know, creating recipes that people who fear bread, and we people that are frightened of bread, actually can embrace it and enjoy bread. And I think that's what's made me happy. I met Vanessa last year, and I can actually remember from May I started making bread, and my health got better, and my weight management was better, and everything started moving again. So really appreciate you sharing. So yeah, let's get some questions. And thank you, Howard. Yeah, I mean, it's, I think bread is a gift of health, which, you know, if we do it right.
So I'm just going to scrape by this bowl as you're chatting. I think, Alex, one of the things that I found most difficult when I gave up wheat and I gave up bread, when I had really bad IBS symptoms in my 20s and I literally couldn't eat bread, was I would eat bread anyway.
Yeah, me too. Total self-destruct.
Just have this.
All the bread.
Oh, it was awful.
It's addictive. That's why it's full of addiction stuff.
I would know it was going to make me poorly. I'd eat it anyway.
I am the same.
So, you know, because everyone's having a barbecue, people were having something to eat, and I just think, well, maybe this time, maybe.
That hot dog bun.
I know. And then the next day I'd be like, I'm you.
KO'd for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Vanessa, are we going to unmute people, or are we going to get people to type in the Q&A?
Alex, are you able to do that?
I don't know, actually. I'm just having a look. There's a Q&A bit, so people can type, I think.
Any of you participants?
In the Q&A. I'm just looking at... I don't think I've got the power to.
I've got a dough on my hands, but I can still. Yeah. Right, okay. So if you've got dough on your hands, a really good way of getting the little bit of flour on your hands and give your hands a good look. Ethan, come over here. You've done a fantastic job of this. Come have a look.
Yeah, it looks cracking.
Yeah, look. Yeah, come have a little look. Look at that. Yeah, all yours. Let's have a little look. So we've got questions here. We've got about, I don't know, 10 of 10.
I did have two questions from that actually Lucy forwarded. I could tackle those just to one of the people that did them. So
yeah, fantastic.
The question I would tell was a really great one about kefir. So kefir or kefir is, you know, it's a fermentable, I mean, the one I'm used to is goat milk, but it can be a dairy milk, it can be an animal milk of a different sort, and it can also be water-based or coconut-based. But what it is essentially is a powerful, you know, the question was about probiotics, these friendly bugs. So prebiotics feed our bugs. Probiotics are extra bugs that we can take in diet or supplement form, which help our bugs work better and try and suppress the bad bugs that we have. And I thought it was a great question because they were saying, look, you know, does kefir actually, can it help with people who've got lactose intolerance? So lactose intolerance, and so people with IBS often say, well, dairy blows me up like a balloon. The lactose intolerance is a deficiency or an insufficiency in the lactase enzyme, which sits on the top of the cells of the gut, particularly in the small intestine. And in certain ethnic groups, they have a, you know, very recognizable lactase deficiency. So particularly Asians and African Americans just massively downregulated. So they have problems with eczema and all sorts of things because of it. But we also, particularly irritable bowelers, can have a lactase deficiency. And when you give yourself probiotics have got a myriad of great health benefits to the gut. But one thing they can do is help food intolerance. Now, we're not talking food allergy, which is very different. But food intolerance is not an immune system response. It's usually a problem with enzymes. And if you help the gut cells to be healthy, help the gut bugs to help the gut cells be healthy and also be much more, happy in their own environment, then your intolerances tend to get better. So I thought it was a really good question. So yes, kefir can help. Let's have a look. Come on, let's look at that.
I like that question. And I'm very, very glad you've asked it. So this is almost ready for me to go in the fridge. People often ask me what I'm looking for, and it's actually kind of the shine. It's got a little bit of kind of response.
Hold it up a bit, Vanessa. That's it.
You see, this is just about to go in the fridge upstairs.
Yeah.
Now I'm going to put a few more sprinkles on it, and then I'm going to ask Ethan to pop it up in the fridge. And then this is going to, it's always better, Alex, to go in a little bit. I don't know, I if there's a problem, I'll leave it on the deck tomorrow morning. I'd rather it was slightly under-fermented than over-fermented.
Yes, mine were overflowing the top of my Banneton yesterday, so I had some terrible Frisbees.
Oh, well, you know, it would be very digestible.
It was very digestible. It's going down like a house on fire.
You can look at the upside.
Happy accidents.
Pop that in the fridge upstairs in my library, yeah? Yep. And just when you go in, check the temperature of the fridge on the fridge thermometer.
What do you want it to be?
Well, I guess I'm hoping it'll be about 6 degrees, but if it could be 10, and there's two fridges, so stick it in. If it's about 10 degrees, that's fine. So that's another tip, fridge thermometer, Alex.
Yeah, I know, absolutely.
It's got different temperatures in them, and it's going to make all the difference to where your dough goes. So interestingly, if your dough is running away, you can put it in the fridge in the coldest spot.
Yeah.
If you think, oh, I've got to go out and my dough isn't quite ready, you can put it in a warmer spot in the fridge. So it's not the only thing, is not just the system. It's actually what you then do with your dough. Yeah. It's really, yeah, really interesting. So, and actually, I completely agree with you about lactose intolerance. I suspect my daughter at the moment, I think, has a lactose intolerance. I have lactose intolerance. There's no question about it. My mother has lactose intolerance. So
I think it's really common. I mean, I don't know if I'm allowed to plug. Am I allowed to plug a particular kefir?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so the one that I will plug is, people are interested, is called Chuckling Goats. Chuckling Goats are a fantastic company. They offer microbiome testing. You can do a 6-week course of kefir, which I would say is take it like a medicine. Mm-hmm. And you can demonstrate with them your microbiome changing to flourish. And they provide a fantastic customer service. I use them. When my gut wasn't great last year, I felt that and the sourdough were the only things that really worked. So if you're interested, Chuckling Goat are fantastic. And they will, if you sign up to their subscription, they give you loads of discounts. So it makes it really affordable. If you think about it as a health intervention, I think it can change lives. I send lots of NHS patients there.
It is incredibly interesting. And it's also, it's the galacto-oligosaccharides as well that impact on the bifidobacterium. And as if you are a member of the Sourdough Club, you can go and have a look on sourdough.co.uk, look at the different types of microbes. And what you will be able to read further on the club is that bifidobacterium is actually one of the positive bacteria in your gut directly associated with actually making the hormones that Alex was talking about earlier, is serotonin and actually GABA as well, which are they're neurotransmitters. They're kind of neurotransmitters, I guess.
GABA's a lovely calming neurotransmitter.
Yeah. So serotonin and neurotransmitters, which again, you don't really think about this, but by eating something that has got the food that feeds the microbes, your microbes are then able to make the things that your brain needs. So it sounds really obvious. If I said to you, your car needs petrol to run, thank you, Ethan, and you start your car engine and nothing happens, and you're like, and they'll say, well, and your fuel gauge is on zero. And it's so obvious. It's like, the car doesn't work. Did you put any petrol in? No. Well, why is it that we can't make that connection? So many people, or even the government, I mean, don't get me going, but actually, if we're not feeding ourselves what we need to function correctly, we stop functioning correctly. It's as simple as that. And it sets off a chain reaction. So very often, what I see is massive restricted diets actually feel good to begin with, and then actually they exacerbate the problem.
Yeah, make a problem downstream, totally downstream.
One of the biggest problems I often see is people giving up gluten. One particular study of 30 healthy Spanish men who actually went on completely gluten-free over 3 months. By the end of the trial, this intervention, their gut diversity was massively reduced. And what was interesting was the specific microbes and the specific ability of the body to break down the wheat, like you said, had disappeared. So when they then went back to eating bread,
disaster.
The bread was even more difficult because they'd actually reduced their capacity. I really have to say with sourdough, let the microbes in the sourdough start to do the work for you. Yeah. Why would you even try and digest wheat if you took a look at it? I mean, you only have to look at it, Alex. And I mean, I'll just grab, if you could, Ethan, can you do me a favour? Can you go in that very, very corner of that box and just grab me? There's a big pile of wheat. And before we head off, Alex, I want to show you something. Just in the right of the corner behind you, big pile of wheat.
Yeah.
That's it. Right. Let me show you what we're eating. Okay. Let me show you this. It's going to make you laugh. At what point did you say yum? Yeah. At what point, Alex, did anyone,
after my teeth,
decide that this was good to eat? They must have been desperate.
Yeah.
To for early mankind to have thought, yum. This, so in some strange way, you know, you look at a strawberry, it says, ooh, come and eat me. I mean, that's like,
it's a good looking fruit.
Yeah.
It's a good looking fruit.
This one, so if strawberry say, come get me, what does this one say?
Run a mile.
And then some. So if you are going to eat this, you need some help. And that is the microbes that break it down. So it is no wonder that people have issues digesting. And that one we were actually looking at then, yes, was actually a collection from Ed Dickinson, who's actually an amazing heritage grain breeder. He got three at the school here who helped me. So there we go. Ferment it. Increase your probiotic with it. Relax and enjoy your bread. Make sure that you don't self-diagnose. So make sure that you really do actually have IBS. And if you are in any doubt, talk to your own GP.
Definitely. Yeah.
Any last kind of words of advice?
I think it's just, you know, I think sourdough really is the route to creating or converting bread from being something to fear to something which is a huge pleasure. And actually, if you can see it as a lifestyle prescription, is actually beneficial for your health. And I'm glad I found it because I was so restricted. I was eating, and I think just a quick one on gluten-free products. If you look at the color of them, they are white and beige. How that doesn't nuke your gut, I don't know, but we don't want the white and beige of the world. So I think get long fermenting, get your hands in the dough, connect to the dough.
There is one tiny part of this I haven't mentioned, and sometimes I shy away from it because it's negative, but I'm going to say it. Many of the emulsifiers in bread are and have been proven irrevocably to contribute to lowering gut microbial diversity. And we know that the combination of dietary emulsifiers combined with refined white gluten is actually associated with gut dysbiosis and therefore IBS. So one of the things that absolutely horrifies me, and coming back to what you say, is that the absolute truth is that eating refined white carbohydrates, starving your body of fiber, and these dietary emulsifiers that the big manufacturers use may very well be the cause of the very IBS that makes you give bread up. So we have to rethink the system on what we're doing.
Absolutely right.
So cool.
Enjoy bread again.
Excellent. So we'll have to get these recipes on in the next week or two.
Cannot wait. Hurry up.
No, well, Ethan and I will be turning these into great bakes in the morning. Ethan, do you want to come say goodbye?
Yeah.
Come on. I'm so proud of him.
Listen, it's fantastic. He's come on leaps and bounds. It's absolutely brilliant, Ethan. I want your job.
For your job at the moment. Yeah, he's doing really, really well, and at some point I think he can kind of run some of these himself. But
brilliant.
I'm extremely proud. He's doing photography, baking, and obviously he gets a bit of my opinion all day long.
I would say lucky. Now I'm joking. Well, have a good Easter, everybody.
You lovely too. Alex, thank you. Enjoy very it. Much
a pleasure. Always an honor to be here. Great to see you. Hi,
I really hope you've enjoyed listening to this. If the idea of prescribing baking as lifestyle medicine as an evidence-based approach to your patients to help them improve their physical and mental health through the bread that they bake, eat and share every day appeals to you, then go to thesourdoughschool.com and learn how you can prescribe or teach this as part of your own practice. If you have just fallen in love with the whole concept and you just want to learn to do this for yourself and your family, you can self-prescribe at thesourdoughclub.com. I look forward to seeing you in some of our live sessions. Don't worry, I'm not going to give you a long list of sponsorships and things that you need to buy. Instead, I'm just going to explain. What we do is we teach baking as lifestyle medicine. This is an evidence-based approach to baking, eating, and sharing bread that improves the gut microbiome and mental health. So let's just get straight into this podcast.
I would like to know what IBS is, because it's so broad. And I would like to know the triggers for IBS, and then we'll come back to looking at bread and sourdough and how that might help. I'd love to know if there is a relationship between IBS and mental health. I know I read a very interesting study recently talking about the relationship, and the number of people who have depression was significant. It was an Australian study. It's on our database, but it was a report looking into the way that IBS affected people's illness and mental health, and what the association is. And then perhaps we could maybe talk about some of the approaches using bread making that people can actually actively step up to help people with IBS and make sure that it is IBS. There are others that are very, very similar that I will talk to you as we go on. So going back to what is IBS, can you give me a definition of what it is?
The simplest definition, Vanessa, is we have no idea. And that's the problem. So IBS is strung under an umbrella term of functional gut disorder. What that means is that if we biopsied, if we opened up people with IBS, and I'm one of those patients, if we opened up IBS patients, people who complain of irritable bowel syndrome, they would look totally normal. And that therein lies the problem. So it's a functional problem. We can't biopsy you and go, oh, look, you know, like with celiac disease, you know, there's a complete anatomical abnormality here, or there's inflammation there. Everything looks normal, but clearly, because of people's symptoms, it's not normal. So it's a functional gut disorder. And it's characterized, the main symptoms people report are bloating, are abdominal pain, and then people often are either bunged up, they're either constipated, or they're rushing to the loo and they're diarrhea. But for the very unfortunate people, they can be bunged up or they're rushing to the loo. And symptoms are often better when people have gone to the loo. Some people find identifiable triggers, but really it's very difficult to manage in the NHS. It's very difficult to manage full stop, really, because we don't really know the underlying mechanisms. It's felt that probably key players in irritable bowel syndrome are problems with motility. So what I mean by that is the gut is a huge muscular organ. And if that doesn't contract properly, then you can imagine that digestion doesn't work very well. Things either get, if it's too slow, you're bunged up and things ferment. And I know, Vanessa, we're going to talk about fermentation and things with the sourdough regarding that. If it's too quick, then things are rushing through, they're not being absorbed well, and they're ending up in the large bowel, undigested, unaltered, and there's problems there. So it's a tricky one. And I think the key thing that we want our audience to know is it's very underdiagnosed. So we think roughly, and Vanessa, you talk about this in your sourdough book, that about up to 20% of a population has got irritable bowel. I suspect it's much more than that. And the reason I think particularly in the UK it's much more is the UK does not like to talk about bowels. Women are much more likely to go to the doctor. Women don't like bloating because, we wear, tighter fitting clothes, and I think bloating is something that females tend to know because of the time of the month. We can see our bellies up and down. And it's not a nice feeling. And I think women are more likely to present to the doctor. They're more likely to have irritable bowel syndrome. But I think a lot is underdiagnosed because no one wants to go to the GP and say, I'm really farty, I'm really bloaty, and I'm running to the loo all the time. I think a lot of people just put up with it. They say, well, that's always been me. I've always had bad guts. And I think that's why we've got a tip of an iceberg with irritable bowel, actually.
So, Alex, I'm going to ask you a question that actually has been asked of me recently by one of my students. Around about the time that she has her period, her pro-estrogen, I think, drops. And then she gets constipation. And is that a very common thing to happen during a woman's cycle? So are there times of the month when it's not IBS, it's actually hormones dropping?
Well, I think the key thing with Someone actually asked a question, we can cover it later, we can cover it now, about sex and IBS, which I thought was a great one. I've never been asked about sex and IBS, but actually IBS is very hormonally sensitive. So I think the reason it's more common in women is it's linked to estrogen and progesterone. Those are the female hormones. Testosterone, which is a male hormone, very dominant male hormone. Women do have testosterone. Testosterone seems to be a bit more protective, which is why I think we see a lot more IBS in women. But definitely what you find with women who've got irritable bowel syndrome is they see their symptoms cyclically along with their period. They can map their irritable bowel. And the question about sex was, you know, does sex make irritable bowel syndrome worse? And I'll cover it now because we're talking hormones, and I think it's a good question. Is it definitely does. Because when you're having sex, actually sex hormones increase inflammation, which I didn't know. I had to go and do a bit of research on this. That's really interesting. So you've got, if you're more inflamed because of sex and your sex hormones, then you're more likely to have bad irritable bowel.
Is that estrogen coming up, or is there any?
Yeah, so it's estrogen and progesterone. And the other thing is that because when, you know, there's a particular hormone with the pleasure side of sex called oxytocin. Now, what that does is drives all the good stuff, but because it's very excitatory, which is of course what everyone loves, it also makes your other organs very sensitive. So if you're someone who's got a sensitive gut, the irritable bowel syndrome people, if they're having sex, that big rush of good hormone, the pleasure hormones, actually makes their gut much more sensitive. So they tend to actually find their irritable bowels worse with sex. So it's very hormonal driven. So your student definitely is, it could be irritable bowel, or it could just be the female gut being more sensitive to hormone.
So we know that we've got, you know, I mean, I've read lots of studies this week because April is, I think it's World, or it could be National IBS Month or World IBS Month. I can't remember, but I know that this is the month that kind of all the charities kind of really get on board with it. So when you've got IBS, I've had a few scary moments, Alex. So one of the problems I've had over the last 10 years is I've had 6 people who've been very specific about their bowel issues, somehow willing to talk to me, a baker, about them, but too embarrassed to talk about it with a doctor, yeah. which is very interesting.
With terrifying people.
Yes, absolutely. But one of the difficulties is, and that one of the things that really frightened me half to death was in the very early days, and it's happened, I mean, you have to imagine, I speak to hundreds and hundreds of people. But over the past decade, I would say I've caught 5 absolutely definite people who've got bowel cancer.
Yeah.
Very common. I was horrified to discover that I think at the moment it's the number 4 cancer in the UK. We are told that it is a preventable cancer in many instances, not all, but in many, because its lack of fibre is one of the drivers towards
yes.
it. And one of the reasons that we're so driven by increasing fiber. There are some very similar, and what we see is it's a very similar problems that look like IBS, and people self-diagnose, I've got gluten intolerance, hence yeah. they come to me because they think sourdough must be the answer. And when I listen to what they've told me, my alarm bells have gone off, and I thought to myself, I mean every time anyone speaks to me about themselves personally, I'm literally have to say, go straight to your GP.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm a lot, but I'm not a GP, you are. So what are the alarm bells as a GP that you are like, do you know what? You really have to get your actual, backside.
I think it's a really important point. I think there are what we call the red flags, where, like you said, the alarm bells, and these are things which can be age-related. So anyone over 60 that has things like change in bowel habits. So someone who always says, like, I'm regular as clockwork after my morning coffee. And actually, I'm finding I'm going 2 or 3 times a day. So going to a more loose pattern, that can be an alarm bell, depending on the age. Unexplained bleeding from the back passage, which is not piles. So it's not an obvious thing. Again, it depends on your age. But again, if you're worried, speak to your GP, particularly if you've got bleeding that you're not sure where it's coming from. Any weight loss, which is unintentional. I think most people have gone the other way with a lockdown. But, you know, if you suddenly think, hang on, my belt notch is doing it up, that, and you haven't been actually actively doing anything, you're more tired. They're very vague symptoms, people, but they can be very real in terms of diagnosis. So changes in bowel habit, particularly more towards more loose, and bleeding. I think, are key. And if you're young, if you're 40s or 50s, then it's a few other things like the unintentional weight loss.
So I'm going to talk about triggers here for IBS. And I'm also, as is probably some people struggle with slightly, we were talking about poo, whilst we're going to be talking about cherries and star anise, but we're going to talk about sourdough and triggers. So for this recipe, what I've done here, Alex, is I've actually...
I really hope you've enjoyed listening to this. If the idea of prescribing baking as lifestyle medicine as an evidence-based approach to your patients to help them improve their physical and mental health through the bread that they bake, eat and share every day appeals to you, then go to thesourdoughschool.com and learn how you can prescribe or teach this as part of your own practice. If you have just fallen in love with the whole concept and you just want to learn to do this for yourself and your family, you can self-prescribe at thesourdoughclub.com. I look forward to seeing you in some of our live sessions.